I was here a couple weeks ago and talked about just the experience of moving toward and moving away in our meditation and in our lives, and how we can move toward things without wanting to grab onto them, and moving away without it being out of a unwholesome type of aversion. So this is kind of a continuation in some ways, what I'm going to talk about this evening, starting chanda, the Pali word chanda. As probably everybody is familiar, that the Buddhism in the Four Noble, there's suffering. It's the way everything's set up. It's like bound to disappoint. Nothing's solid or nothing lasts. It's just baked in, and the cause for suffering is often translated as desire. But there's actually two words that get translated as desire, and they're actually, I think they're opposites of each other. And one is tanha, which is I love the translation of that as an unslakable thirst. So just the grasping for things that will never satisfy us, and the more we chase after them, the bigger the longing becomes. Like with the ultimate, I don't know if it's the ultimate example, but a strong example of like building a tolerance to a drug, where it doesn't matter how much of it you do, you keep doing more and more, and you can't get the impact that you were after. That these things just snowball and become worse and worse the more we chase after them. That kind of grasping desire. Someone asked J.D. Rockefeller once, how much money is enough? And his answer was, just a little more. So we kind of live like, oh wait, I'm getting it now. Okay, I'm gonna get it all settled, and oh yep, it's gonna be fine. Let me get it all tamped down. Oh, it's fine. And then it changes. But we, just even those really simple feelings of just wanting it to be in control and getting on top of it, and oh, I'm gonna have it together, and just even those very basic kinds of longings that life is sure to show us that no, we don't have it all together, and whatever we thought was going to make it just right, like, either doesn't or it's going to change. The other word for desire, chanda, is the opposite of that, which is the desire to awaken, the desire or the desires for yourself and others to not suffer, like those kinds of desires that are wholesome and will not create that I want this and it burns and burns until there's nothing left. Not like that at all, quite the opposite. So the desire to practice, I'm pretty darn sure that everybody that's on this call has a lot of chanda, or this is not where you'd be on a Sunday night. Like we all have a desire to see the truth, to awaken, to be more free, and to cause less harm for others and for ourselves. So those two kinds of cravings, there's a quote from the Dhammapada from the Buddha. Whoever is overcome by craving, his sorrows grow like grass after the rains. Whoever is overcome by craving, his sorrows grow like grass after the rains. For those who overcome craving, their sorrows fall away like water from a lotus leaf. For those who overcome craving, their sorrows fall away like water from a lotus leaf. So, yeah, the Buddha uses imagery to evoke all kinds of feelings in us, all kinds of positive motivations, and that's like an invitation to evoke positive desire, the desire to not want to chase after cravings. He's like, the way he says it, it's like, oh yeah, wouldn't you want that? Doesn't that sound good? Doesn't that sound better? And then another quote from the Dhammapada, it is wisdom that enables letting go. Sorry, it is wisdom that enables letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness that is greater. So yeah, the motivation to let go of what doesn't, is not going to satisfy, and to turn towards something that actually brings a deeper kind of satisfaction. That's what Chanda is about. And the Buddha certainly had plenty of that in his own life, in his own story. Though from what I can tell, he didn't start out with it. He was a pampered boy who his father was doing everything he could to make him want to stay home and be the heir to one to lead the clan. But something told him to go outside the palace, to go take a look, which, this is just me talking, my thoughts on this, that was way-seeking mind in him, like what's called bodhicitta, awakening mind. That was giving him a clue, like, oh, this doesn't seem like there's something missing. There's something more. So he went out and saw the heavenly messengers that had a huge awakening impact after being so sheltered from sickness, old age, and death. He saw for the first time a sick person, an old person, and a dying person. Say more about the way-seeking in a minute here. But yeah, when he decided to leave and become an ascetic, clearly he had chanda, he had the desire to awaken. It's just a quote from the book The Life of the Buddha, which is a very cool book. It gathers all these quotes from the suttas and from the commentaries to like take you through his life with the actual words of the Buddha or the most, I don't know what word, renowned commentaries. But anyways, it's from there, from that book. When he left home to go be an ascetic, leaving the overly hedonistic sort of lifestyle to go be an ascetic, he said, "Now I went forth from the house life into homelessness to seek what is good, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace." So he wanted to be with, once he'd seen the realities of life, he wanted to figure out how to live with that in a way that was good and true and in line with reality, after having so much hidden from him for his all his early years. And then, of course, the ultimate positive desire was, he sits down under the Bodhi tree eventually, and it's like, I'm not getting up from here till I totally wake up. So I don't know if that's the ultimate chanda, but it's somewhere up there. And once you're awakened, one is awakened, then one doesn't need chanda anymore. You're already there. So it's you don't even have that desire anymore. You've overcome all desires by the time you reach enlightenment, or so that's so the promise is. So yeah, in real time in meditation, just to ground that a little bit, I was guiding us a little bit about using wise effort. That's one of the parts of the Eightfold Path, Just the sense of like noticing, oh, there's something that's not so good that's arising, and not like going, oh, get rid of that, not doing that, and not getting swept away in it, but being able to hang with it. Like, oh, what is this? How does this feel? And likely it ha probably has some wanting, not want or not wanting in it. And on the other side is like the calming factors, the concentration factors, the things that stabilize us, so that we can allow these things to come up that are states we don't want to get pulled off into and just swirl in, right? We notice them coming up, and we make an effort to do something about them once they have arisen, so they'll be more likely to go away. And once they have gone away, we work with it to like, oh yeah, let's keep, like if you feel any tug for that, you notice it, and you want to keep those things at bay if they've gone quiet. That's the one side of wise effort. And the other side is noticing, like the second you get any little bit of calm, like, wow, okay, wow, that's better than it was. And usually, if you check, if you got a little bit of calm, there's also some enjoyment of the calm, or it gets, said joy, which can feel like a high bar for an emotion, but just that you can, enjoy that you like, oh, calm, that, oh, yay, I'm going in the right direction here. So just noticing those kinds of things, like helping them arise, like through using the breath was the main thing I was encouraging, and awareness of the body, whichever your meditative focus is in your particular sit. Just using those that the awareness of the arising, and then keeping the positive states arisen. Just quieting unwholesome states when they've gotten worked up, and then keeping them quiet, and encouraging wholesome states to arise, and keeping them arisen once they've arisen. Like, is the effort to be made in our meditation. So, the commitment, I'm going to overcome all my craving of Chanda with the big C. Like, we don't just get there, we just don't just come out and have Chanda, but we do have way-seeking mind, or bodhicitta is the Pali word, like bodhisattva, awakening, the bodhi part, and then sattva is being, an awakening being, and bodhicitta is a awakening mind. Especially in the Mahayana traditions, I think they, seem to find they talk about this more. But it's like an innate spiritual compass. That's my words. And we're born with it, and it's the part of us that inspires the search and orients us toward the truth and goodness. And it both seeks enlightenment, and it's already awakened. So we don't create it. It's an innate quality that arises spontaneously that we all have. We're all born with it. And like even Rudy Giuliani has bodhicitta. Even Vladimir Putin has bodhicitta. Our really dear teacher Kitasaro likes to talk about the fable of a person who goes out seeking the whole world, looking for the precious jewel, and all the while the jewel is on their forehead and they just can't see it. So in a way, like the bodhicitta's pulling us out into the world, it's pulling us out to look to look for what to connect with what will awaken the awakened part of what will connect us with the awakened part of us. I think that's a fair way to say it. Yeah, and the Buddha story again, like when he was had become an ascetic and studied with a few teachers and kept moving on, like, this isn't quite it. I'm not there yet. And had deprived himself so much of sustenance that it's said like he touched his navel and could feel his backbone. That's how much he was wasting away, and could barely sit up. And the thought came to him, might there be another way? And it's the moment where he realized, oh, it's not hedonism, it's not asceticism, it's the middle path, the middle way. And the Eightfold Path is, our map and tour guide up the road to awakening. So yeah, in that moment, clearly he had the bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind. Might there be another way? So as I was looking at all this and thinking about the wholesome desire, there's wanting and not wanting. There's aversion. So it's like, well, is there wholesome aversion? And it's like, well, yeah, there is a concept for that. I don't, I think that's a close enough, like synonym. The word samvega means like spiritual urgency. The Zen folks talk about like practice like your hair is on fire. Tan Jeff, I think he's Ajahn Tenasaro now. He used to be Tenasaro Bhikkhu. Anyway, so it's all the same guy. Tan Jeff, when he defines that Samvega has three components to it. There's spiritual disillusionment, that the sense of disenchantment with the world, like you've been in an illusion and you're waking up from it, and it's hard. It's like, wow, ow. It's not how I thought it was, like when the Buddha went out and saw the four heavenly messengers. So there's the disenchantment, and then a feeling of complicity with what's wrong, like I'm part of this problem, I'm doing this thing, and then a determination to find a more meaningful way. Which, wow, that's a lot to have in one word, one concept. So it's like, I can't hand, I don't like how this is, and I want to do something to change that. That ugh is what I'm calling wholesome aversion, samvega. It's something you can find like at the bottom of the pint of ice cream, or the morning after the party where everything doesn't look so nice anymore, everything doesn't have the glow it had if somebody's over partying the night before. But also it's just a sane response to how unsatisfactory and unstable life is. We build on what's not stable, we won't be happy. So just the understanding of that and of the instability, the existential reality. Like Sartre has a whole book called Nausea that is this. I mean, it's basically samvega, but I don't know that the existentialist had a path exactly, but just the feeling of like, oh, he called it nausea. But then, of course, like with all the like the unnecessary suffering around us and the inequality and all of that, it's even more, even more like a healthy thing to have a aversion to it. Always love this quote from Wendell Berry, the poet Wendell Berry from the Mad Farmer's Manifesto. To be sane in a mad time is bad for the brain, worse for the heart. So to be sane in a mad time is bad for the bodhicitta, having that the not taking illusion to be real, to be disillusioned, is the sanest thing to be. And yeah, the Buddha had his disillusionment from seeing the heavenly messengers, seeing an old a sick person, an old person, and a dying person for this for the first time. But he also, it arises at the same time he sees a wandering monk in robes. So there's another concept practice that goes hand in hand with Samvega that's Pasada. They're meant to be cultivated together. And Pasada is like when you find a reliable way to address the spiritual urgency. So the clarity and confidence, the joy of having of finding a path, of having a path, a thing you can try that promises to solve the problem of Samvega, like what a relief. So, I mean, for me, practicing on this path, it's like this is the best thing I've found. I've checked out a lot of stuff. This makes more sense than anything else. I'm just going to keep giving it a try, see where it gets me. Like I have a thing to do, that keeps me going. Yeah, just that sense of having it takes away confusion to have a path. I'm just going to put my foot, one foot in front of the other in this way and see where it leads me. I think this is going to be good. I think this is going to be better, is what keeps me going. That's part of my posada. It sounds like a Spanish word. I think that means something in Spanish. I don't know what posada, but yeah, and we don't just have that all of a sudden. Like when for any of us coming to explore this spiritual path, like I had to spend a lot of time listening to teachers and meditating and reading books and hanging out and having conversations with Sangha friends and all of that to start to build my own direct experience of that lead, that gives faith. So yeah, we all support each other along the way until you start to get your own verified experience. Oh yeah, this is working. So we all support each other that way. And there are times when it's really easy to go back to sleep again in a million ways to just forget the things that we were disillusioned with. So that's part of like why the monastics frequently chant the five remembrances. That's I am of a nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of a nature to sicken. I am of a nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever I do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So the heavenly messengers and the reminder that the only thing we own, the only thing that is ours, is our actions, and that they they accumulate into how our life unfolds, the choices we make and the actions we take. So that intentionally stirring up the reminder of, oh yeah, that's right. This is, I'm going to die one of these days. Let me make my decisions about, what's on my to-do list in light of that. Just keeping that, right there all the time. The monks and nuns have a very have that way and other ways to keep that samvega just alive and fresh, and the feeling of like, right, I have to turn to practice because this is the way toward freedom. I just wanted to say something about my own path with this, and in a few minutes we'll have some breakout rooms that you don't have to go to. You don't have to be in a breakout room. I hope that everyone will stay and you can ponder on your own or journal if you don't want to talk to other people just yet, or in this context or whatever. Like my story, just thinking of the Buddha's story with these qualities in it, and then it, made me reflect on my own story, which I'm hoping that each of us can do a little bit of. But I was very backwards to the way that the Buddha, was very protected from suffering. Like I was in my youngest years, my dad worked at a what would have been called an asylum years before. We lived on the grounds and outside the gates of a place that was filled with all of these people that couldn't, at that time, couldn't live in regular society. It was supposed to be for people who were intellectually disabled. That's the reason it was built. But then everybody with, there was no special ed programs or things. All kinds of people that just had difficulty learning got thrown in there, and then all kinds of people with spastic disorders, and the Americans with Disabilities Act made it so a lot more people could be out in the world. And we all got used to seeing people out in the world, but back then they just like kind of put everybody away. And that's what I saw between the time I was 2 and 5. Like we were the weird ones because we were normal, and there were all these people with, really extreme disabilities. And it was a facility that was out in the country between Washington and Baltimore, but it was a DC facility. And DC at that time was like super, it was like 80% black people. So most of the people, the majority of the people I was seeing were disabled in various ways, but were also a majority black people. So it was like this, what? just something I took in really young. And then we moved to the suburbs of DC after when I was 5. And the whole time I always felt like something's missing here. Something's what? Where is everybody? Because they were very white suburbs, and everything was neat and trim, and that's not what I had seen in my youngest years. So I kind of had my heavenly messengers before I could even comprehend what is this. So I just always had this like little bit of I just had some underlying urgency and way-seeking mind that eventually led me here, which was a good move to be around what was going to satisfy, what was going to feel like I could be on a right track. And of course I grew up during an era where there was a generational samvega, just like most of my generation going, no, what's on offer? We're not doing that. It's like the when I was 13 was when the year that Martin Luther King got assassinated, and like 6 weeks later, Bobby Kennedy got assassinated. The war is going on, like all this kind of stuff that was like, no, we're not, the draft and picking lottery numbers and hoping that, for low numbers for the young men you knew, like all of that was just like such a huge, just vast sumbaga. Like, no, we're not going along with this illusion of that this is the way that we should be conducting ourselves. So, I just wanted to mention one little piece for me of like how did I ever start to hear about meditation, because it was not a thing, for younger people it's like it's been a thing probably that you heard about a lot, but it's not something anybody talked about really until the Beatles went and stayed for months on end with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and transcendental meditation made its way back into England, the United States, various places. And I still didn't know in high school, for a while, I'd never known anybody who meditated except one friend, Paul, went and learned TM. And what I remember about Paul, I still know him. He's back east and we have contact periodically. But what I remember the most about Paul was just he had this presence. Well, a lot of people would be like flipping out because their brother was getting drafted or, whatever the thing was. And Paul would be with people in this way that just touched me so much. He would say, "Do not freak out. Under no circumstances are you to freak out." And it's like the as good advice as I've ever had in my life. And it was because, it came out of somebody who realized, like, oh, there's a lot of ways to make things worse. Let's go and calm things and not do that. Let's not make them worse. So, he was my wandering monk of the four heavenly messengers. He was the first person I knew who meditated and had a quality that I could really appreciate like that. And I talked to him a while back and just asked him, "Do you still meditate?" And he said, "Yep, every day." Every day since then, he's meditated every single day. So this is like well over 50 years. So so that was just one sign for me, one that passada, oh, there's a path. Oh, there's a thing maybe to do. And I wasn't doing it yet, but it really, that was the beginning for me of perking up my attention about it. Closing now. So yeah, just wanted to end with a quote I found from Shantideva. It was I think he was lived in the 700s round end, that wrote the Way of the Bodhisattva. So this is a quote from him. He said, "The instant bodhicitta or way-seeking mind arises, even if you've been caught up and wretched, you become a child of the Enlightened One and someone worthy of reverence. The instant way-seeking mind arises, even if you've been caught up and wretched, you become a child of the Enlightened One and someone worthy of reverence." So everybody finding their way here, I think, makes us all worthy of reverence. We can share that collectively here, just taking a moment to come back within and just notice any resonance from our time together in the body and the mind. And any goodness, any merit, any blessings from our time together. Just letting that radiate through your whole being. Sharing that among all of us here. And sending well wishing out in all directions for all beings. May all beings be safe. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings awaken. May we awaken together. Thank you all for being good company on the path.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.